Okay, I'd like to get started. I'm Peggy Goodman. I'm the Chair of the Family Violence Prevention Forum. This is our last session, unfortunately, of seven that we've had this year. We're in our third year. We have over 1,000 members, and we'd like to encourage you to join. If you haven't already, we'll pass around a sheet if you'd like to give us your contact information. And I'm thrilled to be able to have the session, Plans for Peace, Pennsylvania's Family Violence Prevention Policies, Programs, and Practices. I'm not from Pennsylvania, but Pennsylvania is known nationally for its family violence initiatives in advocacy and policy and programs, so what better time and way to do things. So I'm very pleased today to be able to have as speakers Secretary Estelle Richmond, who is the State Secretary of Public Welfare. She has formerly been the Director of Social Services, Commissioner of Public Health, and Managing Director of the City of Philadelphia. And Donna Byrne, who is the Executive Director of A Woman's Place, the only domestic violence program in Bucks County, which is an adjoining county to Philadelphia. And Pat West, who is a public health consultant, social work, specializing in forensic epidemiology, who works with the Philadelphia Department of Public Health and has established and helped establish many of the child death review teams and women's death review teams, has been involved with the Philadelphia Women's Death Review Team, and also serves on the Pennsylvania Attorney General's Medical Legal Advisory Board on Child Abuse and is one of the founding members of the Family Violence Prevention Forum. And the first speaker will be Secretary Richmond. I'd like to sort of hold questions to the end and then perhaps have all the panelists come up together at that point, and we're hoping to allow plenty of time for questions and answers.
How do you want to do this? Want me to speak from here?
It's important to speak from there because that is recorded. Ah. And so it ends up in the total APHA
system for access.
Okay. So that people can listen to the speech long after it's made.
You know, one day we're going to probably not come to meetings. We're just going to put it all on a jump drive. I decided that everything these days is on jump drives, and you'll just plug it into your computer, and there the speaker will be, and you'll just webcast it and Twitter it around. It sounds like a world for my grandchildren. I'm not sure whether it reaches me yet. I still like people. Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to be part of the forum and all the things the forum has done, and particularly for being part of this panel for domestic violence policy. And I'm going to talk specifically a little bit about what we've done here in Pennsylvania. But I think we mirror what many states are either struggling with or where they're heading. We've sort of learned by being very active in the field. I've been fortunate to have worked with the governor over the last 7 years, and prior to that working for him 8 years while he was mayor. And we were able to do a lot of things here in Philadelphia that we were then able to take to the state. Overall, I think we wish we always could have done more and have put more development in many of our services for domestic and family violence. But I think that as we look at it and under the circumstances of the time, I think have been able to make some progress. Before I go much further, let me introduce Joanne Grossi. And Joanne is the director of our Office of Women's Services for the Department of Public Welfare. So she may be joint answering questions with me, since she is my upfront person who does the detail around our office. And we are now getting ready to plan on how do we make sure this particular office is maintained through the next administration. And anytime you change administrations, you're often at risk for the new secretary or the new governor to undo what we believe is a good policy. We developed the Office of Women's Services under the Department of Public Welfare in order to actually better address these kinds of issues of domestic family and sexual violence, among other concerns that specifically related to women's issues. A fundamental driver behind the creation of that office was to bring together services for women under one umbrella so that we could be sure the services we provide were integrated, efficient, and appropriate to meet the needs of our constituents. For many people who've worked with me over the years know that my mission in life has been to tear down silos and to integrate services. So anytime anyone dangles anything in front of me, one, I have to figure out what I can integrate it in so we stop having these silos, and secondly, how to get them more efficient and more accountable. The mantra of the day is that the taxpayers of the world want more accountability on how tax dollars are to be spent. I would tell you that fighting that doesn't work. So we need to figure out how to make it work for us. And how do we make sure that we can always talk about our outcomes, what we're achieving, and how our services are making a difference? If we can't make sure people understand how our services make a difference, we're not going to be able to maintain the services, and they're critically important. Previously, at least in Pennsylvania, services for women were set in all of our different offices, and the Department of Public Welfare has 7 different programmatic offices, all pretty large. Because of that, systems were sometimes inefficient, I would say sometimes often inefficient. Sometimes they were fractured, and the concerns that women face were also often not given adequate attention. I'll say just in this, not this is recorded, I would say frequently in the past, many of the people who were in charge of our policy, I'm not sure, understood the issues of women well. And therefore, the attention paid was not at the level we thought it should be. In relation to family violence, domestic violence, and sexual violence against women, that inadequacy represented more than simply a challenge in administration of services. It really represented a serious roadblock in our efforts to protect women, prevent violence, and help victims to recover and gain independence. So we really wanted to elevate the attention these issues received. We wanted to increase awareness, which continues to be one of our primary priorities, and we wanted to expand access to services that represented part of the solution. So in essence, we wanted to elevate them and the attention within the general population. We wanted to increase awareness of the problem, and we really wanted more services, which means we needed to determine how we were going to either maintain the funding or increase the funding. So we restructured the services. We created the Office of Women's Services, which would give us a single point of accountability. We put it under the Executive Office, which meant it reported directly to me. We have found that if we start having things report directly to the Secretary, it gives it a level of status that people pay attention to. And then once it's established, once we've gotten it pretty well developed and incubated, then we may move it under another program office so that we have a better opportunity to be able to get continuing funding. We've done this several times, and it's actually worked very well in the department, but the key to it is where we started and what's the level of attention so that everybody else knows it's important and this is important. It has helped give domestic violence programs more prominence. It has helped raise the visibility, so people now know where to go for help. They have a point of accountability. In addition to raising public awareness and increasing our ability to work with community partners, this initiative has really helped change the landscape on developing domestic violence policy for women in Pennsylvania. And that has been part of the goal. We've been working to implement policies that support our missions and goals throughout the department. So not only does Joanne work with all of the providers, she works with all of those 7 departments to make sure they understand the importance of women's issues. So whether it's in our Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, our Office of Medical Assistance Programs, whether it's with women within our Office of Children, Youth, and Families, or in our Office of Long-Term Living, which is working with elderly. The importance of women's services touch every single one of those. We've been analyzing, reviewing past practice, and looking for ways to improve the services we provide and how those services are delivered. Our work has focused on 2 primary objectives. The first is to conduct a thorough program analysis and review our outcomes for the services we provide. Again, if we can't produce outcomes, we're going to have a hard time convincing people to put money in. So outcomes become very important. The second is to break down the silos. that have obstructed access to service and hindered our ability to provide integrated and comprehensive care. So again, the two ones are outcomes and breaking down the silos to get integrated care. We're looking at research being conducted on a national level. We don't want to reinvent wheels if someone else is doing it and doing it well. We want to steal it, copy it, figure out what they did and do it. We also want to help set some of those models so people can see what we've done, and we're quite willing to share that. We have reviewed all the best practice standards implemented across the country and the outcomes that those practices have achieved. We're looking at statistics, coming up with evidence-based solutions for program development. We've worked with foundations, community partners to disseminate this information and gain valuable feedback for have gotten some really valuable feedback for opportunities for positive change. However, when we first sought to evaluate our services on domestic violence and sexual abuse, we found we were missing some very important information that we would need to move forward. And that is, we didn't have enough data. We found that people actually were collecting data, but we didn't have a source of how to bring that data in, how to analyze it, how to use it, because that's the basis of how we go forward. I'm sure you will hear in some ways what Bucks County has done, and we found that many of our county programs had data. It's just that we weren't beginning to take that data together, use it, analyze it, and make it work for us. And that's some of the things that we've been working on now, on how do we collect that data, how do we analyze it, and how do we present that data in a way that will give us a better opportunity to increase the number of dollars in the program. I wish I could tell you that it didn't take money, but I don't think that's true. Unless somebody is working for Love and Kisses, they really need to pay the rent, pay the mortgage, and buy the food with something other than you did a good job. Atta girls go a real long way, but not far enough. So as we're moving forward, we're making changes that help us and our community partners gain that data information and use it to provide better programs for the people we serve. In every contract we do now, we're including a requirement that outcomes be measured to establish a baseline for the services we provide. And as we expand those services and make policy changes, we'll be able to measure ourselves against our benchmarks. We're actually doing this against the entire department. So while we're implementing it here too, we actually, throughout the Department of Public Welfare, have required in all new contracts and appropriations language around measuring outcomes, collecting data, using the data. People sometimes collect it, analyze it, but don't use it, and using the data to set new goals and to measure benchmarks. This focus on evaluating our effectiveness and conducting outcome measures really helps to achieve our goals of protecting families and providing comprehensive services for victims of domestic violence. For our second major focus, breaking down the silos, we have found any number of opportunities to collaborate and cooperation, which has made a real difference in domestic and sexual violence services in Pennsylvania. For example, this forum focuses on domestic violence, but you will note I continue to reference sexual violence as well. That's because these issues are interconnected in many ways, and we need to think about providing the broadest level of service, not trying to cut up services in individual pieces. And we've had any number of conversations in bringing develop our domestic violence partners and our rape crisis partners to understand those interrelations. And I think everybody intuitively knows, obviously, sexual violence is violence and against women, and it can be domestic, but it doesn't have to be domestic. But both of them come together, and that they're done mostly on women, although we're seeing a small movement now on both domestic and sexual violence against men, particularly younger men. So whenever we meet now with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence, we also meet with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and vice versa. So we have, these groups have really been working together, bringing their boards together and understanding that how in working together we'll get a better bang for our dollars and how to do it. It is a culture change. We've really operated in silos, but I think the enthusiasm of bringing together and working together is catching, and people are prepared for that culture change. We've also been supporting a pilot program here in Philadelphia. which we believe will come a model for the rest of the state and country, which is integrating or looking at the integration between domestic violence programs and behavioral health programs. We believe in many times, whether particularly the individual who is a victim of domestic violence needs that level of support, counseling, often treatment to recover, to be feeling independent and ability to face again many of the challenges this world represents. Sometimes it can be done on a counseling level. Sometimes the depression or the terror has been so ingrained that there's more professional help that is needed. And we're looking at actually using Medicaid dollars to be able to support some of these services, which brings in a new funding stream. Never hurts. So we are in the process of setting standards to do credentialing and certification of mental health providers to ensure women who are in need of mental health services are receiving them from someone who has received specialized training. I'm a psychologist by trade, and one of my issues is, is people can set out a shingle and say, I'm a psychologist, come, and have no clue how to help you. Because they've never seen a woman who's been a victim of rape or domestic violence or family violence. But they treat you generically. We believe that is not a help, and that people who offer treatment need to be able to have some level of certification, some level of credentialing that you know that they understand the issues you're bringing in front of them, and that's our goal. At present, we're the only state in the country conducting this kind of integrated program. It's been operating for about a year and a half now, so we're anxious to end the second year so we can look a little bit more at our outcomes. But we haven't stopped just within the walls of our own department. We've been working hand in hand with the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency, who is our long-term partner in domestic violence and sexual violence programs. We have convened a domestic violence task force, which has been working for the past 14 months to explore the effectiveness of current policy and make recommendations on areas where we might have a positive change for services for victims. The task force has about 30 individuals from various areas of expertise, domestic violence, mental health, law enforcement, legal, family planning, disabilities, and survivors. A draft report of their findings is under review and should basically be released in early 2010. We're beginning to see some positive impact on our work. Across the state, we've seen a marked increase in awareness of the issues surrounding domestic violence and the services we provide. We've seen pilot programs go into effect to integrate care and services, and we will build on that success. We've been able to maintain the funding from the state for these programs despite of the economic downturn. The budget impasse, if we got through the budget impasse without these programs taking a cut, they didn't get higher, but they at least didn't have to go down.
Say something about the budget impasse, because folks that are not from Pennsylvania
don't know,
and it was monumental.
In Pennsylvania, our budget, New Year's budget starts on July 1st. So every July 1st, there's a new budget. The governor does his budget address in February of that year. So in February 2010, the governor presents his version of the budget. The legislature has from February to June 30th to debate it, to ask questions, to interrogate us, and to pass it. Normally, we're late. So the budget usually gets passed sometime in early July, usually before July 15th. 15 days, not a disaster. This year, the budget passed 101 days late. Our budget passed on October 9th, I believe. And during that period of time, for the first 6 weeks, state employees weren't paid. Well, that really didn't go out well. You're talking about having unhappy people. We had unhappy people. But it was further than that. All during that period, for all 101 days, most providers weren't paid. Now, providers might have a small little fund, contingency fund, to exist for 30, maybe even 60 days. That's 2 months of no funding coming in. Staff, services, people expect to be paid. Our agencies went 101 days without payment, without receiving dollars. Where we could, we tapped some federal dollars. We were able to get some federal dollars to some of our domestic violence. Believe me, I was literally manufacturing money. Can't tell you how I did it. But we managed to keep everybody alive. until the money started to flow, and it has flowing now. But a 101-day impasse killed some providers. Some of them aren't going to come back. Some of them went down. Some of them just couldn't bear it. And most of them, unfortunately, were, again, services that affect women more than anything else. It was our child care providers. They're small. They just could not maintain that long a wait. And while we tried to plug in lots of pieces of money, families withdrew their kids, went to home daycare or their next door neighbor, and there was just no way to maintain it. I think in every state has found ways to live through this recession. Some have done it by doing massive cuts to human services. Others have done it by just the debate of what should and should not be cut. The governor drew his line on education. That was where he was not going to take cuts. DPW and healthcare services were probably second in line to maintain it. But we're living in an environment that says, I don't want taxes raised no matter what. I assume you're in this room, you're doing something within the public nonprofit sector, which means you're paid by tax dollars. And our job begins to help people translate how those tax dollars are being used and that we all aren't out to some sophisticated level of fraud, which they believe general nonprofits do, and we are. And the more we get that message across, the more we get people to understand the importance of what we do and why it's critical. People like you come into fields like this because of compassion, because of passion, because you care, and because you make a difference in someone's life. And I hesitate to ever think of what would happen if all the folks who really make a difference and in life of an individual stop doing that. The devastation that I think would occur in families would be paramount to a tsunami coming into any country because we would lose so many people. So we need more people to understand the importance of what you do. I don't think people in my position can say thank you enough and be appreciative enough of the sacrifices you make in being able to carry out your agendas and to carry out the missions of your agencies. I do think that our success lies in outcomes of accountability and in being able to integrate our services as much as we can and understanding that we have an interdependent system that when one grows, we all can grow. When one loses, in many ways, we all lose. But together we can build a better system and together we can continue to make a better life for the families, whether they're in Pennsylvania, whether they're in Ohio, where I spent most of my life, where they're in Denver, where Pat and I both have grandchildren, or in Colorado, or whether they're in any other part of the country. So, thank you very much.
We do have plenty of time if there are one or two questions now. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
You know, we could do this now or later, but I think one of the important pieces that you can share with us is when you look at outcomes, like for the programs that you're initiating with credentialing the psychologist to work with the clientele that really need more than simple counseling, it would be helpful to talk a little bit about what are those outcomes? And so we can do this at the end.
Why don't we do it at the end? Because we'll have the benefit of all the programs. Yeah. I think it'll work better if we can.
Because I think you're absolutely right. You know, we have the accountability is something that if we didn't know it, the word now, we're going to know it 6 months from now. And so framing what kind of outcomes can be easily tracked with the kind of data that is currently being funded versus outcomes that you want to be able to track but are going to need different kinds of resources.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Secretary Richmond. And our next speaker is Donna Byrne.
I knew you were going to call me next.
You had the sneaky suspicion. Who, for those who weren't here at the beginning, is the executive director of A Woman's Place in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, Bucks County, which is adjacent to the Philadelphia area.
Yes, in the burbs.
In the burbs.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to get a sense, since we're a smaller group here, I've met you and you and you, and I know who Secretary Richmond is. Could you tell me, the rest of the audience, like, what your work is in the health field, so I can get a sense of that, and if I get a chance to tailor my remarks that way, I can do that to bring it off the page for you a little bit. What work do you do? What is it, Tori?
Yes, I am teenage females in Chicago, Illinois, doing one of the film, and it's for young ladies to women. But in addition to that, we have increased, I know probably everybody knows about the violence in Chicago. So in addition to that, we've increased our services because we found that there are more fights among females, you know, even with the parents, you know, getting involved in physical fights.
So you're dealing with female teens around violence issues?
Well, I mean, violence is a holistic, you know, just again, the service, and we work with the families as well.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a distorted view of empowerment.
Girls
are making the news now.
Absolutely.
I'm a public health nurse in Philadelphia, and I work with parents of families that have children with special health care needs. So.
And in the background.
Yeah, I'm Michelle Henry. I'm a research associate here in Philadelphia, Public Health Management Corporation. Working research and evaluation of I'm Nancy Hansen. I'm with the National Association of Children's Hospitals and Related Institutions, and one of our focus areas is supporting our children's hospital work around child maltreatment.
I'm Susan Gadley. I'm from Minnesota. I happen to be on the executive committee, one of the co-founders of the forum. I founded the first healthcare-based domestic violence program in the country in 1986. And Pennsylvania Medical Advocacy Programs, that Nancy Dubrow has pioneered for so many years, is modeled after womankind.
Your name was familiar to me when you said it, now I know why. Well, it's before I begin my formal remarks, one thing that I want to acknowledge and say, because we're always so problem-focused, is having the opportunity to build on other programs and bring it locally to fit our communities. Like, we often feel alone in this work, and we're fighting an uphill battle, but we really have many partners that we haven't met. And Susan, your project is an example, and I have to say, and I'm not just saying this because the secretary's here today, honest to God.
So it doesn't hurt.
I've got heels on, except the rest of you do. No, really, I mean, I sincerely mean it, and it will enhance my story back in Bucks County, because I was praising the staff and the board the other day. I mean, you know, people are always on a treadmill and working their hardest and everything, and we had a very good success story, even though it didn't show on the balance sheet for the past year. We had board support from 10 and 15 years ago who put aside funds for a rainy day, you know, so we didn't get all the white out that we wanted, you know, and thought we were poor and all that, but it came in good stead during this past year. The current board is taking on fund development initiatives that they've never done before, but they're actually going to be making the calls, each one of them. The staff last year, I said to them, we're going to be looking at layoffs unless we can pull together, because our services are up 11%, and we all want to keep the services whole. And therefore, you know, I have to think about keeping you whole. So if we all take an 8% cut, which we did right across the board, to get through this year, I said, you'll all have your jobs, and they all rose up to that. And I said, it's going to be more work for less money, because I didn't replace staff due to attrition, except for I had to. And we pulled through, and ironically, morale is better. And now I
was done in getting those federal dollars through at the beginning of this this year, since July. That was, whoever came up with that brainstorm, it was brilliant. Yes, so we couldn't free up the state dollars, the federal dollars came through. So that is a partnership there, and also maintaining, you know, maintaining was good in this economic climate. So I can expand the team even that I talk about, you know, because people don't see that every day. So that's the good news.
Can I just make a couple points? There's almost no reason on the planet to reinvent the wheel. With the use of the internet, other than mine that didn't work in my room last night, for a conference call, but the internet can find anybody and anything in any project and any program out there. For heaven's sakes, rely on the people you find everywhere. Who cares if they're in Montana? If they're doing something close to what you want to do, use them, and they will be happy to be used. So I just think that's so important to know now, and we've got the internet to help us.
Yes, which expands the system of support around us.
Exactly, thank you.
Alrighty. I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of the medical advocacy projects in Pennsylvania. We've already heard a little bit. And I remember Everett Koop was the first one, the Surgeon General, to define domestic violence as a health issue. That was kind of revolutionary thinking at the time. We define medical advocacy as health care-based identification of domestic violence victims who are seeking health services, and then the provision of services within the healthcare setting. So that's what we're talking about as a definition. And there are four essential elements. Ongoing training to the healthcare staff, institutionalizing practices through policies and protocols, identification of domestic violence victims through routine screening and universal screening as much as possible, and providing services within the healthcare setting. In 1993, the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospital Organizations, JACO, you probably all know that, they funded, because that passed, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania funded three pilot projects. There was an urban program, a suburban program, and a rural program. So the urban was in Pittsburgh, the rural was up in Wilkes-Barre, and the suburban was Abington. And I feel proud because I wrote that application. I didn't do it alone. There was a village there, but I'm very familiar with that program. So there were three in Pennsylvania at that time. Then in 95, another one was added, 96, and a fifth one was added. In 99 to 2000, in response to the Healthcare Response Act, the programs expanded from 5 to 42, and Governor Ridge gave an appropriation of $500,000 to that. And then in 2001, he added another million, bringing the total to 83 of these community-based medical advocacy projects that marry the local domestic violence program with hospitals or healthcare-based systems. Currently, annually in Pennsylvania, there's 5,000 victims that are identified through the healthcare settings that otherwise would not have been identified as early, and over 20,000 healthcare providers trained. Locally, I wanted to talk a little bit. Each one has developed very differently, and you know, you can look to a pilot program or a working model from another state, but then that informs you so much as far as you know what's possible. But it doesn't, like, where the opportunity or what door is going to open will vary within your community. Who are the people that care about it, and how it develops within the hospital or without the hospital. In Abington, the project was embraced by the social work department, and they thought that there were two cases, for want of a better word, a year. It's not, yes, it's a good book. But having been at the local DV program, we had over 100 calls from the nurses at Abington Hospital who would just call us right away, so they never made it into social services. So that was like a huge eye-opener, and all praise to the good nurses in the ER. So that was a big selling point on getting us in the door there, because it identified the scope of the problem right there in River City. There was also differences, well, in Bucks County, it developed differently. We had a program-based advocate that was placed at Warminster Hospital as part of her job. There was a Meg McGoldrick, who was very proactive around these issues, was at Warminster at the time and made the space for her to be there. And then it was, when the funding came down in 1999, they were able to spread it through support of BCHIP, it's called, and that's Bucks County Health Improvement Partnership. Bucks has a very unique configuration, and BCHIP is an umbrella organization for all the hospitals and healthcare clinics. That's very rare across the country. So if you can get under their sponsorship, which we were able to do, then it's immediately countywide. I believe that is still unique in the country. The president of the board at the time was also a VP at St. Mary Hospital, which she has backed it from day one, and BCHIP put up, I think, $50,000, and A Woman's Place put up $50,000 to start that. So it develops differently. Another thing that was important was whether to have the advocate based and paid by the hospital or to remain part of the domestic violence program. Again, in each county, there were two different approaches. At Abington, I thought to myself, some woman's going to make a better salary if she's paid by the hospital. I don't know her yet, but she's going to make a better salary. And so that was a hospital-based an employee of the hospital that was hired through the domestic violence program to work there. Bucks kept the staffing at the local program, and I would say both have worked. But my initial reasoning about the person at the hospital making more money proved to be true. So that was that's a good thing. Tremendous culture differences, and I've talked about some of that this morning with some of the people here. I can't underestimate the enormity of the culture difference. Both parties cared about reaching victims of domestic violence. The hospitals are coming through a science door, data-based. Patients, it's not gender-based. So we will talk about patients and all these, it's just science. And domestic violence programs coming out of a political movement where what is happening to the women that are talking to us, as well as to us ourselves, many of us in the movement have moved on from violent relationships, that's what matters. You know, the data was something some bureaucrat did, like mayors and bureaucrats. But the real work was helping the women on the front scene. That was a very difficult culture clash. And we have kind of moved past that. I was saying earlier, if you're lucky, you can honor the values of people who hold them dear, whether it's a woman coming in for service or whether it's staffing in a domestic violence program. If you're lucky, you can hold true to the values, which shift it so it creates a new truth to step through and enable movements. That's part of the creative parts of our work internally. So, but that was quite a struggle, especially in Bucks County, I would say. It was hard. In fact, the advocate that went to the hospital, she used to get knocked because she was wearing dresses and stuff. I mean, I'm telling you, it gets real basic. I'll come here all dressed up. So, These are human things that you won't see in any research paper. You know, just saying. So, let me see. Yes, I talked about the main thing here. Language was different. That was another part of the culture change. But the hardest one was the database, as we've heard this morning already, the importance of it. Last year, we were in Bucks as an example of a local program against the states that we were able to serve 259 women who were identified. Well, they were 257 women, two men, who were identified through the hospital and healthcare clinics. That was with 2.5 staff able to identify them, and 2,295, that's almost 2,300 people were trained. We have found, I do have one story, I guess, where we use the data to inform future work. When we started, we knew the most traffic was through ERs. And Abington was a trauma center, and St. Mary is a trauma center. So there's great opportunity there. And that's why they started in the ERs that had been the focus initially. And what we have found is that we have been successful with inpatient departments also, and we're not sure if that's because the people are there longer, it isn't just passing through, although we have, you know, we have had some impact on people coming into the ER, but we've also had, it's been much more fruitful in some of the other departments, I guess maybe because the time's not such a crunch. I don't know, but that's been one thing that we've then expanded our focus from the ER to other settings within the hospital. Keeping with the theme of good news, I just wanted to give you one example of how it can work on a good day. Some of the people aren't ready to hear from us. Some of the people are coming in for an injury. You know, realizing that you're experiencing domestic violence may be something people aren't ready to hear yet, but we feel like at least if the information is given, that process has started. Other people are more aware and more in a place to take further steps. This is one of those women. A woman came into the emergency room, and after she was screened, it was evident that she had been hurt by her partner. Our medical advocate had seen her previously, so she called the hotline and asked if we had space. We were able to bring her into the safe house. She had a small son and was very frightened. There was a small language barrier, but fortunately, one of the medical advocates spoke her language. There was also a charge against her abuser for hurting her son. She was terrified that he would get to see their son. We referred her to our legal advocacy program for a protection order, and then to our legal assistance program for custody. Once she was in the safe house for about a week, and after she had met with the other program, she started feeling she could trust us, and some of her panic decreased. That's one of the big pluses that we can offer in the hospitals, because we're seeing more as peers. She was able to stay in the safe house until a place was available at the Bucks County Housing Group. She now has permanent housing and calls and stops in to see us. She's doing very well and is now living a violence-free life. So that was, you know, a good story that worked out.